Hello and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name's Alex Gamsik and I am the founder of Honest Politics, LLC. My company does political research for people, not for politicians. Today, we're going through the biggest, most impressive paper I've ever written. It's about climate change and using cost-benefit analysis to measure climate change. And should we even use climate change in cost-benefit analysis? So, you probably noticed that the length of this episode is huge. So I've decided to take the most important notes from a term paper that I wrote, my final term paper from American University, the ultimate paper that took so long and is the summation of my entire master's degree, basically. I took the important notes and I'm putting it here in the beginning in a more conversation style. Afterwards, I'm going to include the full paper read out loud. So if you make it to the end, congratulations. There are some bloopers at the end, like some of my episodes have, so have at it. There are some funny bits where I just completely start losing it about halfway through the paper, trying to read this entire 22-page monstrosity. So let's just talk about climate change and cost-benefit analysis, starting right now. There are many reasons to use cost-benefit analysis. It's a good way to see, like, if this policy costs $1 million, but it provides $2 million of benefits, then we should go ahead with it. Now, it's a little more difficult with climate change because how do you measure climate change? How do you measure the environment? Because this happens in the future, usually you discount the time value of money due to inflation, due to price fluctuations, due to uncertainty with currency values and all of that. So you can't really use normal cost-benefit analysis techniques for climate change. I'm going to go through the 18-plus studies and sources, academic sources, I should note. These are all academic peer-reviewed articles that I'm using as sources. Anyway, so the first study I looked at showed, well, one of the first studies showed that when valued, the environment was like $33 trillion per year. And that valuation is more than the entire human economy combined at $18 trillion. So they were like, well, you can't value climate change because the environment itself is worth more than all the money in the world, and money does not have intrinsic value. It's a made-up human construct. But I kind of argued in the paper that it doesn't matter because you can still use hedonic pricing, which means like indirect pricing, to assign values to things like the environment. And even though like a tree doesn't have a dollar value per se, when you reduce something to a common denominator, when you reduce something to a dollar figure, it gives something for everybody to understand. For instance, like if you live in Long Island, you probably don't understand what a cornfield, how valuable a cornfield is, and not having it because of environmental damage. Whereas if you live in Nebraska, you understand a cornfield pretty well, but you might not fully understand wetlands like in Long Island. You might not understand that because you're not there. But if we value them at $1,000 or $2,000 each, we suddenly have an understanding. We have a common denominator of how much it is. So that's where you can use pricing techniques to get everyone on the same page on how valuable these parts of the environment are. Like in cap and trade schemes for carbon emissions, you can use cap and trade to value carbon, something that doesn't have a dollar value normally. So some of the other studies we looked at directly asked people, how much would you pay for lower carbon fuels? Like in Korea, they did an excellent study asking people, would you switch to natural gas for your electricity instead of coal? Natural gas uses twice less carbon dioxide into the air, but it also costs a lot more. So the people who had higher educations, higher incomes, and anti-nuclear views would pay more in general for their electricity if it was natural gas. But there, people who had high electricity usage were less likely to pay for more energy-efficient natural gas. Then, it's very difficult to do all these measures, to do all these studies. Scholars even disagree on how to place value on these public goods. And in, the environment is a public good, the definition of a public good, something that everyone can access. and is basically unlimited. So it's not regulated. I mean, it's not part of the private market, I should say. Basically, a really good handbook guide I read from Australia's cost-benefit analysis climate change team said the best way to use climate change cost-benefit analysis is a hybrid between qualitative and quantitative data. So instead of just saying the value of this bit of forest is $1 million, you say the value of this forest is that it provides less carbon dioxide and savings in the future. And oh, by the way, these trees would cost $1 million in the private market. If you use a combination of numbers and explanations, cost-benefit analysis is much better in the climate change arena. And they also made it clear that cost-benefit analysis is a tool for decision-making. It should not be the decision-maker. So a politician should look at the cost-benefit analysis, but not say, oh, well, this costs less, so let's do it. They should balance it with real-world implications. Even the most conservative economist in the 15, 18, 20 studies that I read, even the most conservative guy was like, climate change is real. It would have catastrophic effects if it's not brought under control. So, and that's something my business will not entertain, is the notion that climate change is a myth or a scam. It's just not true. Every single one of these scholars is studying it seriously. And if you don't think it's real, you're not serious. That's all I have to say. So future GDP losses from climate change in the future can be as much as 20%. So a fifth of the economy could be damaged by climate change storms and stuff. And it's at least going to be 5% unless it's brought under control. They were saying that a 5 Celsius degree change in temperature would alter the Earth as much as the last ice age did. So that's how serious the weather will change. It makes no sense to put off investments in climate change because spending just 1% of GDP now can effectively deal with the problem. We should be spending 1% of GDP per year globally to deal with this problem. You know, it's not just an American problem to deal with, but if America doesn't deal with it, why would the rest of the world deal with it, you know? We all have to pitch in. Co-benefits like lower pollution happen when you take away coal. I mean, coal emits so much dangerous chemicals, not just carbon dioxide. You are saving people's lives directly in this lifetime just by getting rid of coal. Coal is disgusting for the environment. It emits so much carbon. There's no reason we should be using coal anymore. Even moderate environmentalists are like, yeah, coal should be gone zero. Maybe natural gas is part of the solution because it's so much better than coal. But coal is just get rid of it all. So climate change is unique as an externality, a negative externality, because it is global in nature. It's persistent, meaning it stays in the atmosphere for a long time, and it's irreversible. Mostly. We'll get to that later. Although you can't use a super low discount rate, so like you can't just like, I'll get into this later in the paper, but you can't just say the time value of money is basically zero. You have to account for the fact that this is in the future, and if you're using money, that money is going to be worth less in the future. And also because there might be a technological solution to climate change in the future, that's part of that uncertainty I was talking about. So, you know, you have to take all of that into account. And the discount rate, I have issues with people who have it very close to zero, but I also have issue with people who say the discount rate is the same as any other cost-benefit analysis because climate change is not like any other issue. The discount rate should be somewhere in the middle. Another interesting fact, there's actually benefits to climate change when climate change is around 2 degrees Celsius. Because summer activities like boating, hunting, and fishing will increase in economic activity. United States farms will actually have higher temperatures and more rain, so they'll yield more crops. The problem is that there's feedback loops, and as soon as you get to 2 degrees Celsius, it's really hard to stop climate change. It's going to keep feeding on itself. And when you get to 5 degrees Celsius, the damage and widespread devastation will be such that any benefits are completely wiped out. Even the farming sectors and the fishing sectors are going to be destroyed, basically. Ignoring these effects, like some of the scholars completely ignored these positive effects, that could, you know, open a crack for conservative arguments in the future, people who claim that, oh, look, we're doing great because of the warmer weather. You know, we have to acknowledge and defeat that argument now. So some other studies looked at farmers and they looked at European consumers and they omitted climate deniers from their studies. Like they screened them out before doing their questionnaires on how much would you be willing to pay to avoid carbon emissions. But if you omit parts of the population, that completely distorts your data. Even though they are climate deniers, you're never going to get rid of the climate deniers. So you should be including them in your data to see how they're going to affect the broader economy, because they'll still be around. One of the last studies I talk about, one-third of the Malaysian economy, the country of Malaysia, one-third of them are dependent on agriculture for their living. And climate change is going to disproportionately impact these kind of low-lying, heavy agriculture countries that are close to the coast, which is completely horrible. But when they surveyed the farmers, I want you to take this away. This is one of the last things I say before going to read the paper. What farmers cared most about was protecting their agriculture and avoiding disasters that would affect them. So it's self-interest that the farmers and the people surveyed cared most about. How is this going to impact me? The thing they cared least about in the surveys were the intrinsic value of the environment. People did not care about the environment for the sake of the environment. That is a weak argument. It might be strong for you, might be strong for me, but it's a weak argument for the public. And then protecting future generations? Don't worry about that. They'll take care of it themselves. That was the least important reason for avoiding climate change, according to these studies, was protecting future generations or intrinsically helping out the environment. You have to play to people's self-interest. Because, you know, the older I'm getting, the more I'm realizing the world is centered on self-interest. And if you want to be successful politically or as passing a public policy, cater to those self-interests, help people live better lives, give them benefits, and they will respond positively and accordingly. Now, without further ado, let's get to the giant paper that I read out loud. Here we go. The title is Cost-Benefit Analysis and Climate Change Mitigation, because I couldn't think of anything clever or intelligent. All right, so this section is called Introduction. Global warming, the primary contributor to climate change, is a serious threat to safety and economic security. Warming that has occurred since the Industrial Revolution has already strengthened hurricanes, intensified droughts, and increased sea levels. To combat the worst of global warming, which will intensify over time, a massive undertaking must occur. Most economic sectors will need to become more sustainable, including publicly funded projects. Including climate change mitigation in the planning of public projects is difficult because this topic defies traditional cost-benefit analysis techniques. This is a global intergenerational externality with an uncertain but vastly unequal distribution of consequences. This paper concludes that, although evaluation of climate change is difficult, it is critical to include in routine cost-benefit analyses as part of a systemic effort to mitigate climate change. Next section is called Valuing the Environment. Not everyone agrees that it is possible to assign monetary values to environmental goods. Since environmental assets are not traded in the market, they are not accounted for in gross national product, GNP, despite their real benefits to humans. Scholars calculated that the value of the Earth's ecosystem was $33 trillion per year. So that's how much the ecosystem would cost in dollars, in 1994 dollars, $33 trillion. This vastly exceeded the $18 trillion in global gross national product per year at the time. So basically the environment is twice as valuable as the entire market, global market. Therefore, the price of the natural environment was higher than anybody's ability to pay for it. Other scholars use this valuation to support their claim that economic valuation of ecosystem services is impossible. These authors had claimed that environmental services should be valued qualitatively instead. They wrote that the alternative to having an environment was to have nothing, and that there was no finite amount of money anyone would pay to avoid this alternate state of nothingness. The environment was therefore an essential good because people would pay anything to have it. They also wrote that it was impossible to define the value of a person affected by climate change, and that aggregating over many people degraded any estimate one might come up with. They claimed the economic value to be how much a person would pay for a change in the status quo. Some of their other points were that environmental feedback loops prevented a simple addition of environmental effects, ecologists and economists need to have a better understanding of each other, and that the environmental issues must take a back seat to pertinent issues like malaria prevention. Their final conclusion was that, since money is used in the market and has no value outside of the market, it's impossible to assign a monetary value to the environment. A few of their arguments were faulty. Just because something is difficult to measure does not mean economic valuation should be discarded. Although imperfect, there are ways to measure human lives through a combination of expected earnings, the value of their leisure, and positive influences on others while accounting for their expected lifespan. It's also possible to value the environment using imperfect means, as the previous scholars had done. The private market itself does not always assign correct values because of pervasive market failures. In particular, money's uselessness outside of the market does not mean that items outside the market are immune from valuation. Markets for environmental services can be created, perhaps under a cap-and-trade scheme. Governmental distribution of property rights can essentially assign environmental value to that distributed land as well. More importantly, people need monetary values to understand environmental concepts. Not everyone has visited a wetland or has learned how it impacts coastal ecosystems, but everyone knows what $5 are. Monetary values create a common denominator for people to relate to and a foundation to conduct cost-benefit analysis. In an effort to make environmental factors possible in a cost-benefit analysis, scholars wrote a guide for the Australian government that advocated for a hybrid between qualitative and quantitative valuations. They regarded cost-benefit analysis in general as an information aid to decision-making, but not a substitute for it. According to them, non-market valuation was best performed when financial or environmental stakes were high, and non-market outcomes could influence policy options. They knew that governmental policies to help the environment usually created costs to their constituents, yet they acknowledged that Australia should use non-market valuations in their cost-benefit analysis, like the United States and the United Kingdom had done. Now I'm going to take a quick commercial break, but we'll be right back to talk about valuation methods for cost-benefit analysis and climate change. And we're back. This next section is called valuation methods. When considering three different methods for valuing non-market goods, Redding and Baker preferred the stated preference method. In most of the studies discussed later in this paper, stated preference method was the method used. Redding and Baker did not like the revealed preference method because that method, which used hedonic pricing and travel cost estimates, relied on past behaviors leaving a behavioral trace. This retrospective process was considered incompatible with the predictive estimates needed for global warming valuation. Bakhartri from the United Nations described revealed preference valuation as valuation that emerges from the choices people make. For example, travel cost estimates attempt to capture a national park's value by using the time, travel cost, and opportunity cost that someone must sacrifice to see a park. This method is good because it uses real-world data, but it fails when considering the multiple factors that go into someone's trip. Someone may visit the Grand Canyon not just for the park, but to visit a local college and eat the local cuisine. These additional stops make valuing the Grand Canyon in isolation very difficult. Redding and Baker also disliked benefit transfer methods, as these required a high degree of similarities between each situation studied. Bakhartri mentioned that the benefit transfer method was the quickest and easiest method for non-market valuation. However, she acknowledged this method would be inaccurate without adjustments in the estimates to account for different factors, such as income levels across the people being studied. This could be done using a function transfer, which more elaborately estimates a function of the data provided to conduct a meta-analysis of previous studies. Benefit transfer can also be done using a structural utility model. Either way, the result is a more accurate version of the benefit transfer analysis. Batkhatri claimed benefit transfer was most often used to value visits to recreational sites, so it would not fit well for climate valuation. The best method for valuing global warming and other environmental matters is the stated preference method. This can be done with either contingent valuation or choice modeling. Contingent valuation directly asks for a person's willingness to pay for an asset or service. Choice modeling asks for willingness to pay by giving a participant payment amounts to choose from. Redding and Baker added that the quality of these stated preference methods depended on the quality of their survey designs. They needed to be specific questions that minimized bias. Bias would be incorporated in wording of the questions, but it could also result in a participant knowing little about the subject. For instance, someone who lives in Nebraska may not value coastal wetlands like someone from Long Island. Another flaw in these methods is that they are based on hypotheticals. Participants may inflate or deflate their willingness to pay because they are being presented with a survey and not a real-world valuation with consequence. To work around this hypothetical bias, a contingent valuation survey in Malaysia asked subjects to actually imagine that they would have to pay their stated willingness to pay. Although this primer statement probably helped, it would not be enough to rid a participant of hypothetical bias completely. A survey designer could try to arrange an experiment in which people are made to believe that they must actually pay for an ecological service, but this could be tricky and unethical. Despite its flaws, stated preference methods are the primary source of valuation in Roding and Baker's report. They stated that people may value the environment for its uses, whether they may be direct, like for agriculture and recreation, or indirect, like for water cycle and pollution control. People may also value the environment for its non-use values, which rely on morality or altruism. Non-use values include bequest value, knowing the benefits will enhance future generations, and existence value, knowing that something exists, creating value in itself. Since these concepts are difficult to put on paper or to monetize, they're often ignored in cost-benefit analysis, especially in Australia. Redding and Baker contended that the values described above are real and should be included routinely in cost-benefit analyses. Next section is cost-benefit techniques. Redding and Baker concluded that the Australian government's best practice regulation handbook allowed cost-benefit analysis to include worded descriptors as well as numerical descriptors. They advocated for a cost-benefit analysis that monetized environmental factors when possible, but also provided a written description to make sense of those numbers. The idea was that policymakers viewing the analysis could use it as a tool to be interpreted rather than defaulting their decision to whether the cost-benefit was positive or not. Although this quantitative and qualitative hybrid would provide policymakers with flexibility, it would also raise the risk of double counting environmental costs or benefits in the analysis. If nitrous oxide emissions for a project were estimated to cost $100,000, it would be reflected as a numerical cost. But when a descriptor saying this project would contribute 5% to the state's greenhouse gas emissions would have to admit nitrous oxide as a greenhouse gas, or else it would be double counted. Descriptors would also need a different consideration without regard to discounting. A discounting scheme that is artificially low, which we'll discuss later, would be factored into the numerical data, but not the written words. A descriptor saying these emissions will contribute to global climate change for the next 100 years inherently discounts time differently than the numbers would. Therefore, the authors should have cautioned the readers to be careful with double counting or misleading the readers with effects discounted differently through numbers and words. Now the Stern Report. Artificially low discounting for climate change has been debated among economists. Richard Toll claims that climate change should not be immune from traditional economic discounting methods. However, the Stern Report for 2006 explained why an average or high discount rate would create bad policy on climate change. Stern warns that business as usual with regard to climate change policy would create future damages averaging 5% of global GDP per year. Natural disasters and a loss of the ecosystem services would even result in losses up to 20% of GDP. Stern claimed that the ecological effects of a 5 degrees Celsius increase would change the Earth's climate as much as the last ice age had. To respond to the greatest market failure the world has ever seen, a global, multifaceted policy approach should be undertaken. Stern warns that humanity would need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2050 and ultimately by 80% to avoid the worst aspects of climate change. He calculated the cost of effective climate change policy to be 1% of the world's GDP per year. Therefore, policy action now would cost less than leaving policy action as it is. Stern differentiated global warming from other negative externalities for four reasons, which were later used to justify his artificially low discount factor. First, the problem is universal and global. One extra unit of carbon dioxide contributes the same amount to global warming as the next, no matter where it's emitted from. Usual externalities like noise, pollution, and litter are often confined to the location of their occurrence. Second, global warming is persistent because greenhouse gases take years or decades to radiate into space. Timeframes for externalities like construction noise can be limited to a project's building phase. Global warming is permanent and irreversible, even with modern technology. Third, there's a vast uncertainty about the magnitude of changes to the climate. This uncertainty makes it more difficult to model economically and more difficult to assign values or discount rates. Fourth, economic impacts of climate change are going to be non-marginal because they affect entire economies. Externalities are usually more local and not on a national scale. National security issues are one of those few nationwide externalities, but the Department of Defense has acknowledged that climate change is also a threat to national security. The idea of valuing this unique externality is captured by the social cost of carbon, which Stern defined as a downward sloping curve reflecting the total damage from now to infinity by emitting an extra unit of greenhouse gases. The upward sloping curve on this graph was the marginal abatement cost, which reflected the cost to avoid emitting an extra unit of greenhouse gas. The marginal abatement cost curve was steeper, therefore more elastic. This meant that there was a higher cost to avoiding carbon emissions than there was to emitting carbon. These curves may shift up or down depending on the actual level of emission, and the abatement curve will likely lower as new technologies become available. Man, I remember writing this report and struggling so hard to understand that whole sentence, or that whole paragraph. Stern went on to optimize the social costs of carbon by incorporating falling technology costs and rising emissions. The graph was also noted to fail to incorporate global warming will disproportionately impact different areas of the world. Developing countries, usually depending more on agriculture, have more floodplains and have fewer resources to devote to resilient infrastructure. Oh boy. I mean, they didn't just give you that master's degree for free, did they? So now on to Stern's discount rates. That's the title of the next section. Stern's argument to avoid a heavy discount rate is correct in principle, but the methodology in attaining it seemed too far outside of economic reasoning. His argument was that climate change is cross-generational, so it is unethical to leave for future generations. Unlike climate change, it's unrealistic to build a soccer stadium or an interstate highway for the benefit of the next generation. They can take care of that for themselves, especially since technological innovation has made each generation better off than the last. However, climate change truly crosses generations because it's irreversible, and every generation since the Industrial Revolution has contributed to it. This makes climate change uniquely a shared responsibility between generations. One of Stern's main points was that anyone who cared about climate change would assign a low discount rate, and those who did not care about it would give it a normal discount rate. The economically traditional version of a discount rate figures that the future consumption is devalued due to time preference. A dollar now is worth more than a dollar in the future because of impatience and uncertainty in the future. To arrive at an artificially low discount rate, Stern did not use time preference. Instead, he only discounted to account for the possibility of an extinction-level event, such as the possibility of a meteorite eliminating humanity. Such a small chance led Stern to adopt a tiny discount factor. He believed that it was as much this generation's responsibility to deal with climate change as it is for the future, which is why there was no time preference in the discount rate. Stern was partially correct in that the future generation must bear some responsibility for emitting greenhouse gases that will disproportionately affect people in the future. However, it was bad economics to completely eliminate the time preference factor. To allow only for extinction-level events is an unrealistic way to confront an externality which is going to be more of an issue for future generations to deal with. A more proper way to do this would be to deflate the time preference factor by some amount, but certainly not by the whole amount. The likelihood of an extinction-level event should probably not be used in economic analysis because it is so unlikely, and if it did occur, nothing else would matter anyway. In addition, time would actually solve global warming if a discovery is made that could reverse climate change. There are already hypothetical technologies like geoengineering or carbon capture from the air that may solve the future issue. The precautionary principle advanced by Stern is not enough to disregard time preference completely when possible solutions are available to future generations. Despite this issue, Stern elaborated further on discount rates. He accounted for such factors as income inequality between generations, economic growth differentials, the use of different discount rates for different goods, the differences in people's valuations of welfare, and growing consumption. He used calculus and other complex methods to arrive at multiple discount rates. In conclusion, he acknowledged that his techniques, like the use of multiple discount rates, fell outside the realm of standard cost-benefit practices. Although some of his valuation methods should be revisited, especially concerning discounting, his conclusion to reduce carbon emissions now to avoid even more costly losses in the future was valid. This was primarily due to the cross-generational nature and the consequences of global warming. A more conservative economist, Richard Toll, has bemoaned the application of low discount rates for climate change. He conducted a meta-analysis of 75 studies to calculate a mean climate change cost of $196 per metric ton of carbon and a median estimate of $49 per carbon. The mean cost was clearly inflated by high estimates in some studies. Toll was one of the only researchers in this paper to acknowledge that some benefits from climate change emerge before 5 degrees Celsius, although he also acknowledged damages would occur as well. Some parts of his analysis were odd. His study aimed for a benchmark of 625 CO2e concentration of atmospheric carbon. The Stern report considered anything above 550 CO2e to be catastrophic. No other study even mentioned concentrations above 550 CO2e. So Toll should not be assuming that climate change is permissible at that level. He also claims that discount rates should be done traditionally, because a lower rate would imply inconsistencies between climate change and other areas of public policy. But climate change is clearly inconsistent with other public policies due to its unique features, as previously explained, which make it different from most other externalities. The next section is called Macroeconomics of Climate Change Mitigation. As stated by Stern, it is possible to solve climate change through activities that will cost a significant but not debilitating amount of time and money. Some measures include reduced demand for emission-intensive goods, increased technological efficiency, cheap low-carbon technology, and afforestation, which means planting trees. The Global Commission on the Economy and Climate released a report that claimed climate change mitigation and economic growth are mutually beneficial. To support this was that larger investments in low-carbon technology would stimulate innovation, cities would save money by investing in clean technology, money could be used by eliminating fossil fuel subsidies, reduced pollution would create reduced healthcare costs, and solar energy costs have fallen 80% since 2008. In addition, they cited a World Bank story which estimated the cost of $70 to $100 billion per year from 2010 to 2050 to keep the Earth from exceeding two degrees of warming. The argument was that at this cost, while expensive, it would be worth the long-term savings from global warming. Although some of these studies of ecological relationships seemed overly optimistic, there are co-benefits to investment in green technologies. Dan Fiorino of American University published a book that concludes sustainable development is possible even while growing the economy at a moderate rate. For instance, renewable energy production is one of the fastest growing sectors of the economy and is adding more jobs than coal production. EPA actions to clean up the environment in the 1970s have drastically increased air quality in the U.S. and display the power of economic and ecological co-benefits. So next we're going to talk about the valuation studies. Overall, it appears that the costs of mitigating climate change are very real and need to be accounted for in cost-benefit analysis. Several studies have conducted to attempt to value climate change or the effects of such. These were found through Canada's online environmental valuation research inventory found at www.evri.ca. One study from 1999 used data from 1959 to 1980 to build a Ricardian model that analyzed climate valuation impacts on agricultural land value. They took many factors into account like flood probability, slope length, and soil sand content. They concluded that early global warming would actually be beneficial. Okay, so this is actually pretty interesting. They concluded that early global warming would actually be beneficial to U.S. farms by increasing temperatures and precipitation. But after a 5-degree centigrade increase, these factors would damage farms at least a value of about $30.2 billion to $101 billion in 2018 dollars. So basically, there are benefits to climate change, as strange as it seems, but only to a certain point. Once it gets past that point, it causes massive damage. Similarly, a study considering the impact of climate change on U.S. outdoor recreation found some climate change benefits up to 5 degrees centigrade. Industries benefiting from warmer temperatures include boating, fishing, and hunting. However, activities like skiing would be harmed to the magnitude of $3.7 billion, 51%, to $4.6 billion, 62%, per year. Then, after 5 degrees centigrade, all sectors of recreation would experience financial losses. These two studies offered an interesting perspective by showing that climate change would actually benefit some sectors of the economy. This was not accounted for by Rudding and Baker, nor Stern. Ignoring these positive effects could open the entire practice of climate change mitigation up to debate once the positives of global warming on U.S. agricultural production and recreation begin to emerge. They should have at least acknowledged the positive effects. Rudding, Baker, and Stern would reply to these studies with the concept of feedback loops and exponential warming. Ecological feedback loops occur when warming indirectly causes more warming. For instance, fewer ice sheets mean less effective surfaces for sunlight to radiate into space. Desertification will mean fewer trees to absorb carbon dioxide, and greenhouse gases trapped in ice caps can escape after melting. This means warming will occur at an exponential, not additive, rate, along with greenhouse gas emissions. There are no, quote, good effects from global warming, because the process will continue at ever-increasing rates and reach that 5-degree threshold of destruction as a matter of course. Rudding, Baker, and Stern would instead advocate for a minimization of climate change and ignore its positive effects, even though this goes against traditional economic analysis and financial analysis. More recent studies have used the stated preference methods advocated by Rudding and Baker to value climate change. A 2017 contingent valuation survey asked the heads of South Korean households how much they would be willing to pay to switch from coal-generated electricity to natural gas electricity. Coal is responsible for 43% of South Korea's electricity generation in the first quarter of 2017, and electricity from natural gas was 1.25 times more expensive to produce. The natural gas-generated electricity emitted half the carbon that coal did. It was therefore possible to ask households who knew of climate change's effects, what they were willing to pay for this difference. They found that higher incomes, higher education levels, and negative views of nuclear power corresponded with a higher willingness to pay for natural gas production. However, the higher households' electricity usage, the lower their willingness to pay for natural gas. The authors found an average willingness to pay of 0.021 to 0.023 per kilowatt hour, which they claimed outweighed the costs of converting to natural gas. This study did a great job of isolating how much households would be willing to pay for climate change mitigation. As Stern noted, the costs of climate change mitigation will ultimately be borne upon households. A factor not considered in this study was how much conversion from coal to natural gas would be supported by this valuation. It must be more expensive on the margin for each unit of coal converted to natural gas, rather than 1.25 times more expensive for any quantity. The study did not mention increasing marginal costs to energy conversion in their study. Another international study examined afforestation in Germany. This study was unique in that it measured the value for an ecosystem asset spatially. Afforestation is an important way to combat climate change because trees take a large amount of carbon out of the air and prevent sunlight from reaching and heating the ground. The study measured willingness to pay from people across Germany and found that those near forested areas or those with high incomes placed a lower value on new trees. The marginal willingness to pay per person was 1% more forest when there were no trees around, was 12.6 euros. I made a typo. From there, more trees in the area corresponded with a lower willingness to pay for tree cover until the limit of 57% tree cover. This mean was 6.5 euros per person for a 1% increase in tree cover, or 487 million euros nationally per year. This study did a great job of isolating spatial factors that determined a person's willingness to pay for an ecosystem service. However, Redding and Baker would refute the author's claim that our approach can be readily used in benefit transfer techniques for the entire European Union. Redding and Baker noted that differences in context between studies make benefit transfer a weak valuation technique. This is especially true for environmental goods, which vary considerably between countries. The next study analyzed two other countries within the EU, Italy and the Czech Republic, and found that they had different preferences for environmental goods. This study was not as well designed as the others because it relied on online surveys. Online surveys remove the person-to-person conversation, which may impact the honesty of the participant. They allow the participant to be multitasking while conducting the survey, and there is no guarantee that the person you are targeting is the one completing the online questionnaire. This survey also did not offer a proxy for climate change that people could relate to like the South Korean study did. Participants were asked directly how much they would be willing to pay for a public policy change to combat global warming. They concluded that Italians would spend 133 euros per metric ton of carbon dioxide, less than the cost of the policy, and Czechs would spend 94 euros, more than the cost of this policy. This 29% difference between EU countries shows that a benefit transfer across the EU, as suggested by the German study, would be inapplicable. This study also emerged from a study attempting to value climate change in Britain and Italy. The study used hedonic pricing to estimate willingness to pay by comparing average historical housing prices and wages in areas with different climates. Using temperature and precipitation as measures, the study found that wages did not vary significantly according to climate. They did find that housing prices in Britain were associated with higher temperatures and lower precipitation. In Italy, they found different results, including a lower temperature preference in the summer. This again proved that benefit transfer would not work due to the different circumstances between the countries. Yet another study examined willingness to pay for climate mitigation, but this time for farming techniques that reduce carbon emissions in Australia. Agriculture is extremely important. It covers 38% of the world's land surface and constitutes 15% of greenhouse gas emissions. Carbon farming techniques mitigate climate change through vegetation planting, carbon storage, and soil erosion. The study used choice modeling to determine that of these three methods, farmers were willing to pay for vegetation and carbon storage. They were unwilling to pay for soil erosion because its contribution to carbon farming was not as visible or easily understood by participants. This was a good study, except for their omission of climate change deniers from the sample, who constituted less than 10% of the survey. The climate deniers' lack of willingness to pay should have been included in the study to present an accurate representation of Australian population. Returning to European studies, Scancy et al. From the University of Warsaw conducted a discrete choice experiment to determine willingness to pay in the Czech Republic, UK, and Poland. For a 40% greenhouse gas emission reduction by 2030, Czechs would pay €13 per year and Britons would pay €44. For an 80% reduction by 2050, Czechs would pay €17 per year and Britons would pay €46. For both milestones, the Polish willingness to pay was not significantly different from zero. The researchers determined that Czech Republic and United Kingdom preferred the polluter pays principle, whereas Poland preferred an EU-wide distribution of payments based on GDP. This study did a good job estimating willingness to pay across countries. The last valuation study explored is from Malaysia. One-third of their population depends on agriculture for a living, and grain/maize yields were predicted to drop 10%. In the next 60 years, rainfall is expected to increase -1% to 32%, and temperatures are expected to increase 0.6 to 3.4 degrees Celsius. When combined with a 13 to 95 centimeter sea level rise in the next 100 years, the future looks grim for the low-lying areas of the country. Contingent valuation was used to ask 385 farmers to rank their opinions on global warming impacts on their farms. It also asked for a willingness to pay. The most popular reason for willingness to pay was the impact on agricultural production and to avoid future natural disasters. Consistent with Bakhtiari's claim that developing countries have other priorities, the second least popular reason was for intrinsic environmental value. Consistent with traditional economic discounting, the absolute least popular reason was to, quote, protect future generations, end quote. The mean willingness to pay was 4.42 and the median was 3.08, meaning that some very high bids skewed results upward. Income and education were found to positively influence willingness to pay. This study did a good job ranking farmers' motivations for willingness to pay, which was missing from other studies. To mitigate hypothetical bias, they also inserted a blurb asking respondents to give their willingness to pay as if they actually had to pay. The study suffered from a smaller than normal sample size, only surveying farmers for a global issue, and excluding people who denied climate change. The predicted consequences of climate change for Malaysia were also very large. For instance, the difference between 13 and 95 centimeters of sea level rise would have different effects for Malaysian agriculture. This uncertainty is a feature of climate change policy that makes it difficult to deal with than other externalities. Although Toll thought that climate change mitigation should follow traditional cause-benefit techniques, Stern's report clearly showed that climate change is a unique public policy problem. Redding and Baker wrote a guide with the intent to incorporate non-market valuations into cost-benefit analyses. Given the severity of business-as-usual approaches to climate change, projects should proceed with an estimate of climate change impacts incorporated into their costs. This is difficult to accomplish, but it can be done, as seen with many of the studies above. If cost-benefit analysis estimates for climate change are roughly accurate, their addition to routine cost-benefit analyses would benefit the process of public policy. Thank you for listening to that. If you're listening to this now, send an email to alex@honestpoliticsllc.com. The first three people who respond and send an email to alex@honestpoliticsllc.com will get a special prize from me. Thank you. Have a great day. And I'll talk to you next time as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics. Afforestation is an important way to combat climate change because trees take a large amount of carbon out of the air and prevent sunlight from reaching and heating the ground. However, Redding and Baker would refute the author's claim that our approach can be readily used to benefit